Good afternoon, my dear ones. I'm so, so happy to be with you and to be with you talking about Kali, whom has been irradiating the day for me today. I started really contemplating her deeply last night as I was kind of looking at what we could talk about today in a new way. And even though I could say I'm very familiar with Kali, I've been practicing with Kali, I've been studying Kali, I've been really both loving Kali and being scared of Kali, as I think many of us are for a long time, I had forgotten how incredibly enlivening she is, how when we begin to contemplate her, she literally starts to reveal herself in ourselves as the most intense Shakti. And so I've been kind of roaming around all day chanting Om Kali Ma and just experiencing her delicious ecstasy. And I'm hoping that this will be the case for all of us tonight and in the week to come. One of the ways in which devotees approach Kali Ma, is as her child. Another way that devotees approach Kali is from the point of view of what's called the tantric hero, where we allow ourselves to be kindled, to be awakened, to be enlivened in our active capacity by her Shakti. So today we're going to be looking at both of these qualities of the Kali Shakti, and we're going to be practicing with her, chanting with her in the week to come. So I'd like to start by chanting the mantras that most of us know. They are actually on the original recordings on the website. And we're going to chant 9 times. Om Aim Hrim Klim Chamundaye Viche Swaha. Chanting to the Great Mother. In the form of these seed mantras, Aum, which is the primordial vibration that gives birth to everything, Aim, which is Saraswati's mantra and which is also the sound of creativity and inspiration and beginnings, Shrim, which is the mantra of all the beautiful goddesses and, in fact, which conveys the fundamental beauty and auspiciousness, the goodness of Shakti herself, and Klim, which is the mantra of divine pleasure, which is also associated with Kali, and then the final lines, Chamundaye Viche, and we'll chant Swaha, because our offering, as we chant to Kali, what we are doing is offering everything into her fire, which is also the fire of consciousness. So when we chant Swaha, which has several different meanings, like most great Sanskrit words, but the meaning that I particularly love is this. When we chant Swaha, we are actually saying, I become one with this manifestation of the Absolute. In other words, you offer with Swaha everything that you have to offer in that moment, with the understanding that as oil is offered into fire and makes the fire blaze and then consumes the oil, when we make offerings to Kali, what we are really offering is our sense of separation, our idea that we are somehow different from the great Shakti. So when we say Swaha, we are expressing our wish to experience the face of Goddess as the universe itself. So we'll chant 9 times, and you can chant along with me, or you can listen, and then we will continue with our evocation of Kali Ma. Om Aim Rim Klim Chamundaye Viche Swaha. 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 So begin to allow the breath to flow into your body from all sides, from in front, from behind, from each side, from above, and from below. Remembering in this moment that we are being breathed by that one whose form is the universe and whose form is also our bodies. So just as the wind blows over the Carmel Valley where I am right now, the wind also blows through our bodies, wakes us up, sets fire to our thoughts, to our desires, and to the peace that lives behind all of them. So just allow the breath to flow as if through every pore of your body, recognizing breath as the expression of Shakti, as the expression of Goddess, whom today we invoke as Kali, the Black One, the Goddess whose nature is to devour time and catapult us into the eternal present, where breath flows without effort, where thoughts dissolve, and where we suddenly realize that despite what seems to be, everything in this moment is utterly and absolutely perfect. May the sound of this gong liberate every one of us within its hearing, which is what Kali promises us. One of the truths that comes to me when I begin contemplating Goddess is that the Goddess's path, especially the tantric path, and I think we can say that this is true about the tantric path in general, is that it's a path of devotion. Devotion is not a word we use so much these days. It's not a very scientific word, and even in neuroscience, neuroscientists don't seem to have begun to explore the effect of devotion on the brain and body. But those of us who practice it, which I know includes many of you, know that it is actually an unbelievably effective set of practices for not just opening your heart, but for really expanding your consciousness and your sense of self. And in many ways, devotion is the heart of spiritual practice. Devotion, by, I mean, in the sense of commitment. You know, that's what it means in English, really. The word devotion is related to the word vow, meaning that it implies a commitment to your journey or to your marriage or to your children or to your work. In Sanskrit, however, the word for devotion is bhakti, which carries the connotation of tenderheartedness directed towards the inner self, towards another person, or towards the divine. It's very important in bhakti practice that especially in tantric bhakti practice, that there is this non-dual recognition that when you love another person, or when you love a dog, or when you love your work, what you are actually loving is the same divine energy, the same shakti that may manifest in a limited form in an individual person, but which is not different than the shakti that is of the very face of divine love. So bhakti comes from the root bha, which means relishing or delighting or enjoying. And I think this is really one of the key things about this practice, about devotional practice. It points to the fact that practicing devotion is actually a way to relish or enjoy the taste of sweetness in the heart that comes from opening up to the energy of a deity or to any being, any form that allows you to touch into the experience of awe, wonder, and love. And that sweetness, and this is the crucial part, that sweetness is actually the gift of Shakti. We don't manufacture it. We invoke her, we think of her, we chant to her, and she awakens it in us. It's one of the statements from Abhinavagupta, the great tantric sage, that I like to quote, because it really blew my mind when I first heard it, and it continues to blow my mind whenever I think about it. He said that the power that manifests worlds, when it acts cosmically, it's called Shakti. When that same power expresses itself in an individual, it's called bhakti. In other words, when Shakti awakens in you, when Shakti starts to move in you, one of the main signs is that you start to be able to feel affection, tenderness, sweetness, softness. There are many other things that occur when Shakti is awakened, but when that awakening has been, let's call it pure, when the Shakti is not doing a massive purification, as of course it happens as part of the process, the way we know she's active is because we start to feel this very vibrant sense of presence, often in the heart. And what draws us, I believe, especially to goddess practice, this is certainly my own experience, is that sweetness, that pulsing, engaged, basically life-affirming quality of goddess. Because goddess is life. You know, she's never away from life. And that means she is life in all its aspects, which is one of the gifts that Kali practice gives us. I think that a lot of you are noticing, and those of you who've been doing goddess practice for a long time know very well, is that as you bring goddess energy into your day, whether through meditation or through one of the practices that we've been doing for invoking her, looking for her in ourselves and in the people around us and in the world, that this ability to relish your own life, to see the play of the goddess lurking underneath your mundane experience, begins to emerge, and gradually over time kind of becomes your default. I would say, if I had to say what is my absolutely favorite gift of my years of practice, And of course, there are many because spiritual practice has enormous fruits on every level. But I think the one that keeps me in awe and affection for the journey, no matter what is going on, is this sense of sweetness that is pretty much always present and has been, I would say, since a couple of years into the journey. And that is, I have come to see as the signature of Goddess. Not that Goddess doesn't show up in less sweet forms, of course she does, but part of what she shows us and part of what Kali especially shows us is that her underlying nature is this love, is this sweetness. So the sacred feminine really is all about engagement. Ramakrishna, the great 19th century devotee of the goddess, whom we're going to talk about a bit today, because you can't talk about Kali without talking about Ramakrishna. He was a human version of her in his own extraordinary way. He used to say, Mother, which is what he called her, Mother likes people who play. She doesn't believe in trying to escape the world. She wants us to see her in the world. And some of you may remember this story that I tell it in my book, and it's a story from the hagiography of the great sage Shankaracharya, who was an Advaita Vedantin. That is to say, he taught that the only truth in this universe is non-dual formless consciousness, and that the world and our own body-mind is actually an illusion superimposed on the great potentiality of consciousness. And one of his main teachings to his students, who were guys, who were men, was stay away from women. Women are the very source of delusion. Why is that? I think it's because in societies like ancient India, when you got to a certain age, you were supposed to get married. And for a male spiritual practitioner, getting married to a woman, which was what you did in those days, brought along with it the whole panoply of householder responsibilities, the entire intensity of mundane life. So Shankaracharya would warn his students to stay away from women. And one day he was crossing a river in South India when suddenly the river began to flood and Shankara was swept away. And as he was being swept down the river, he saw on the bank a very old forager woman with wood. She was carrying a bundle of sticks on her back, and she was all bent over. And he called out to her, Mother, Mother, help me, addressing her courteously as Mother. So with an unnatural agility, the old woman threw down her stick, waded into the stream, dragged Shankaracharya out of the water, and then said to him, You fool! You say that women are dangerous. You say that life is a trap. Don't you understand you're insulting the Shakti who is your mother? Nothing would be possible without her. So the stories of life in the spiritual world of India are all about the recognition on the part of stern male non-dual devotees of consciousness that the mother is the source not only of love, not only of illusion, because she certainly is that as well, but the source of love, the source of life. So the goddess, because she manifests as the world, again, as we've said many times, she can reveal herself through anything. And when we begin to invoke her, she will sooner or later start revealing herself not only in meditation, not only in our pleasant experiences, but also in very, very difficult experiences, in sickness, in helping to usher someone we love through their death experience, through ultimately our own death. So the goddess has this way of letting your consciousness, letting your awareness, which is her awareness, open the borders of your separate self so that you can experience that your own awareness has actually become this world, which, as you know, is the entire tantric secret. Everything has come out from within her. And that awareness, which is the source of all of it, the infinite potential of all of it, is your own awareness. It's just that you're a little limited right now, whereas she is without limit. But even a moment of that, of recognizing that awareness, that spacious energy, lets us discover the power and freedom that is at the heart of the journey that all of us are on towards self-realization, towards liberation. So all the goddesses, and remember, every one of the goddesses is one goddess. In other words, the Hindu goddess tradition, the Hindu Shakta tradition, although it certainly is polytheistic, you know, there are many, many goddesses in the pantheon, nonetheless, the deep understanding behind all of this teaching is that goddess, what she really is in her essence, is the perfect eye awareness, what's called the Purnahanta, the I-ness, the aham, that understands itself to be the source of everything. In other words, goddess is not simply a form. She's not that figure of a radiant feminine form. She's also your own consciousness. And as all goddesses are part of the journey towards realizing this, as all goddesses, Saraswati, Bhuvaneshwari, Durga, Lakshmi, certainly Kali, they're all of them open doorways into that awareness. Nonetheless, some of the goddesses are particularly invoked for liberation. For example, Lakshmi, whom we'll just talk about next week, Lakshmi is, although she's very much a goddess of love at all levels, including the very subtle love of the heart, she's also a goddess of worldly prosperity and abundance. Saraswati is, though she gives boons and also insight into spiritual life, she's primarily a goddess of creativity, liberation, language, music, art. Others of the goddesses, and Kali is one of these, of course, are primarily liberators. Their major, I hate to hesitate to use the word function, but their major gift is the tearing away of the bonds that keep us stuck. And though we often think that Kali's liberating work is inimical to our life, in other words, when we begin feeling Kali's strength, we can get scared that she's going to take away everything that we love. This is, in my own experience, radically not true. Kali, what Kali liberates us from is our belief that we need to have these things in order to be ourselves, in order to be in life. And sometimes she does this by taking stuff away. Sometimes she does this without taking away anything except the attachment that keeps you stuck in it. But, you know, mainly, Kali's work in our daily life is as the goddess that we turn towards for liberation from negative ego and negative karma. And it's for this reason, among many others, that she is in some ways the most striking, the most famous, really, of all the Indian goddesses. Of course, she's dark and fierce, which means that she's associated with endings, with dissolution, and with everything, this is important, with everything that is hidden from us. With, you know, she's associated with the truth that we only find by going very deep inside. She's also, of course, the form of the divine feminine who's active in powerful and even cataclysmic change. There's an article which, if you haven't seen it, I will send it to you in the next few days. I'll send it to the listserv. Not Deb will be happy to know, not that I'm going to ask Deb to send it, because Deb is going on a much-needed 4th of July vacation. Yay! But it will come to the listserv. And this is an article that was written after the 2016 election about how Kali is giving her power to awaken the world by bringing so many things to a head, of course, not just in the American political system, but all over the world. And, of course, one of the ways that this is happening is through the At Me Too movement, which is expressing the powerful hidden currents of feminine rage that have been damped down for hundreds and hundreds of years, coming into the public sphere instead of being confined to the family. Feminine rage, of course, has always been expressed in private. But At Me Too and the intense backlash that's coming from certain quarters are both expressions of this transformative energy of Kali. She is the fierce grace who teaches us by showing us, rubbing our faces often in injustice, in our own mistakes, and in the oppression that comes from out, that seems to come from outside, but which, because nothing is outside, is always mirroring some way that we're oppressing ourselves. So Kali is the fierce grace who shows us the limits of human ego. And paradoxically, once she's shown this to us, she reveals, I believe, more powerfully than any force on earth, at least in my experience, the extraordinary intensity and ecstasy of divine love. So, for those of us who can see her face in the midst of the changes in life, in the midst of the impermanence that often terrifies us, she becomes Kali Ma, literally the sweetest of mothers. And of all the goddesses, Kali is the one who is best invoked when what we want is an intense experience of the heart of the ecstasy of the divine feminine. So let's meditate for a moment on Kali's form. You can close your eyes, and you can do this in a comfortable seated posture. Some of you might want to lie down, although I really want to counsel you not to fall asleep. Imagine for a moment that you're lying on a beach, a tropical beach. It's very warm. The sand is soft, and the sand has molded itself around your body. As you look up open-eyed into the sky, which is dark, dark, blue-black. It's a moonless night. The sky is spangled with stars. You're in a place where there's no light pollution. You can see the entire sweep of the Milky Way. And as you gaze up into the night sky, you begin to realize that one of the stars, one of the lights in the distance, is actually flowing towards you, moving towards you through the sky, coming closer and closer. And you realize that you are being, you are in the sights. You are experiencing Goddess Kali emerging from the darkness of the night sky. She comes closer and closer. And for this moment, you allow yourself to truly open to her presence. Imagine her now hovering in the air in front of you. Her color is almost indistinguishable from the color of the sky. She is dark as a rain cloud, dark as midnight. And yet her skin shines as though there's light beneath it that's making it translucent, that sparkles. Gradually, as you become used to the darkness, you see that her eyes are large, that they are looking into your eyes with a look that is so deep, so strong, so ancient, that you feel as though you could fall into her eyes. You see also that her hair is wild and that as she moves, she's dancing. And her hair flies around her. And you feel how incredibly strong she is, how incredibly ecstatic she is. Your eyes move to notice the necklace of skulls that she wears around her neck. Tiny skulls, large skulls, they move in the breeze as she dances. That one of her arms holds a bloody sword and the other a severed head. And yet somehow, even though these implements that she's holding are so weird and wild and scary, that her face is filled with love, filled with an amazing capacity to just open us to anything and everything. So let the goddess, in all of her splendor, reveal and conceal herself. And as you watch her, as you let yourself be present with her, begin to say inside yourself the mantra, Om Kali Ma. 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 there are several stories about how Kali comes into being. And in almost all of these stories, she's seen as a manifestation of the goddess's anger, which is pretty interesting to me because, of course, anger is one of the least socially acceptable qualities for women, especially for wives. And many of the stories about Kali have to do with her manifesting through the goddess Parvati, who is Shiva's wife. Her original creation story, of course, comes from the Devi Mahatmayam, when she arises out of Durga's forehead at the height of Durga's battle with the demon Shumba and Nishumba. One of the demon host, who's called Raktabija, whose name means blood seed, literally blood seed, he has a magical power whereby whenever he bleeds, 100 demon warriors spring up from each drop of blood, which pretty much makes him invincible. So Durga, as she sees his quality in Raktabija, she becomes furious, and out of her forehead she emanates Kali, who is unbelievably fearsome. She's haggard, she's emaciated, her hair is wild, she's extremely ugly, she carries these weapons, and she has this long tongue with which she licks up every drop of Raktabija's blood. And then with her sword and her head chopper, she mows down the entire field of demon warriors. And in the story, in the myth, she hangs their skulls around her neck and their limbs, their arms, around her waist. We'll find out that these implements have a symbolic significance. But after the battle, she's so filled with the frenzy and with the ecstasy of her battle dance that she goes on dancing, and she won't stop. And she dances with so much force that the earth begins to tremble, the heavens begin to tremble, the gods become terrified that the worlds would be destroyed. So finally, Shiva, her eternal consort, manifests himself on the battlefield and lies down beneath her feet. And Kali, looking down, sees that she's standing on the prone body of her husband. And she stops, and in that moment, her rage turns to sexuality, which is part of the mythology of Kali. She carries these twin, extreme qualities of radical anger and radical sexuality. So she sticks out her tongue in a gesture which indicates that she's ready for erotic play, and we don't see what happens next, but we assume that Shiva and Kali go on to dance in a divine embrace, and the worlds become fertile and peaceful once again. And for those of us who, you know, want to start looking at the esoteric meaning of the symbols, the drops of Raktabija's blood represent the endless flow of thoughts. And one of Kali's boons is literally to absorb and dissolve the discursive mind, the default mode network, as it were, into her own being. So this image, of course, has a very profound esoteric meaning, and it's also one of the core images from the tantras. You know, in so many of the symbolic depictions of how the universe manifests, we're shown this image of Kali standing on Shiva's prone body. And what this image esoterically indicates is that Kali is the dynamic force in the cosmos. Shakti, of course, is the power of the cosmos. Shiva is the ground of being. So we could say that Shiva is being and Shakti is power. That's one of the ways the two are described. So he's the pure witness consciousness that is present to the dance of the mind, that wakes up in the middle of the dance and provides a wider perspective so that the flow of Shakti can actually be contained and channeled. And in the tantric tradition, it's often said that Shiva actually creates the fundamental structure or container within which the goddess's wild dance can be, as it were, harnessed productively. Shakta practitioners, of which I'm one, sometimes dispute this idea, but it's certainly a very powerful way to understand the form and the formless as they're represented in this particular depiction. It's said that Shiva is, without Shakti, is Shava, which means corpse. He's inert because Shakti is his power. And it's also said that Shakti without Shiva is crazy. So the two of them together make a world. And one of the things that we also see in this story, of course, is that this same energy, the Kali energy, can be destructive and or creative, can be embattled or playful. And, of course, that sex and death are two sides of the same intense energy. I sometimes tell a story about a vision that I had of Shakti, in which I saw her as this pillar of kaleidoscopic color, dancing eternally in an utterly ecstatic freedom. And as I watched it, I could feel the ecstasy of this universe and the unity of it. And then I realized that it wasn't going to stop, you know, which is the thing about life, doesn't stop. And after I'd been present with it for some time, I started to want to rest, you know, to stop looking, but I couldn't. And then I became aware that I could take refuge in the calm of the witness consciousness, in other words, in Shiva. And I sort of redefined myself as the witness of all of this. And as it were, lay down like Shiva in his prone position and allowed myself to be entertained, to enjoy this wild dance of the goddess. So, breathing in, allowing the breath to flow in from the front, from the sides, from above and below. Feel that the inhalation brings in the mantra, Om Kali Ma, Om Kali Ma, Om Kali Ma. We're going to return to this mantra again and again. Feel as though as the breath flows in, the particles of breath carry the mantric sounds, Om Kali Ma, Om Kali Ma, Om Kali Ma. And as you inhale, feel that the words, the mantras come into the heart. And as you exhale, feel that the mantras spread through your body. In contemporary popular culture, especially in the West, the figure of Kali has come to stand for a certain kind of, let's call it, over-the-top transgressive intensity that many people are drawn to and also frightened by. So in women, Kali has become a kind of archetype for expressing qualities that women have historically repressed. So, you know, and obviously most of us are much more comfortable with the nurturing, the obviously nurturing feminine, the receptive feminine. In fact, we tend to define the feminine as being that quality in consciousness that is nurturing and receptive. So qualities like aggression, anger, sexual intensity are problematic for human women. And I do believe that that's why we're both fascinated and scared of Kali. And of course, when our Kali energy is unconscious or disowned, it does come out in the form of rage, and not only in women, but really, we could say that from a certain point of view, the Kali energy is the energy of war. You know, it's the energy of violence. But this is the shadow energy of Kali. And we could also say that the quality of Kali as the goddess of endings is one of the utterly necessary forces in the cosmos, because as we know, nature is only partially sweet. Creation always involves destruction. Evolution happens as evolution happens, as the, you know, the extraordinary flowering that we call evolution happens. It also involves the destruction of many, many individuals and species. So it's, you know, the dinosaurs are only one of the dramatic examples of species who have been evolved out of existence because they couldn't adapt to changing conditions. And that quality in the universe, which we're experiencing so profoundly now in so many ways, is one of the ways in which the Kali energy manifests in the natural world. It's part of the way self-organizing systems operate, that, you know, I believe it's thousands of cells, maybe hundreds of thousands of cells in the human body that die every day so that they can regenerate, so that our body can continue to be regenerated. So Kali is a natural part of life, but she's also a very hidden part of the psyche, and very much identified in human beings with problematic qualities, qualities that cause suffering for ourselves and others. And that's why at a certain point it becomes very important to bring the shadowy Kali into the light, simply so it can be used for transformation. If we don't make the Kali energy conscious, as, you know, all of you readers of Herr Carl Jung know, she will manifest through external events. She'll work her transformative power through illness or accident, and or by cutting our ties rather dramatically to old habits and people who no longer serve us. When we can bring her to consciousness, however, Kali becomes the force of truth, and that's when she actually begins to give us a kind of fierce integrity, which, you know, is a very noble and also rather difficult path to walk, where we learn how to hold to truth in every situation while at the same time holding to love. And that means always being willing to look into your own emotions, your own anger, your intense desires, to find the core energy within those strong emotions. Anger can be a sign that something has to change. Powerful sexual urgency can draw you into a relationship that will result in creating a lot of karma, some positive, some not so positive, but it can also be a sign that you are being called to celebrate life force, life energy inside your body. She can give you the power to say the truth in difficult situations and to act in a revolutionary way at times when all of your desire is for safety and hiding. So what's important is that we learn to find the core power at the heart of these intense energies rather than dissipating them by acting out, because that's when Kali starts to reveal the gifts that she holds inside the psyche. And this is really important. That's when Kali energy, when the Kali manifestation is not something that we feel is being done to us or that's happening to us. It's actually a significant internal energy that can be the source of transformation. So, as I speak, we're going to talk a little bit about the iconography of Kali. One of the things that we spoke about last week and that I find really interesting, especially when we look at her, is that she has evolved as human consciousness has evolved. So Kali is a very ancient goddess in India. The mythology about her seems to have surfaced around the 6th century of the Common Era. And in her early appearances, she is, as we said in the description of her origin story, she's extremely ugly and extremely fierce. She often is shown with fangs. She's wizened. She's hag-like. Her hair is wild, and she's always scowling. So the skulls around her neck in this particular depiction of Kali reveal her as a death goddess. You know, she's a war goddess. And in her early manifestations, she was often described as the Ishta Devata, the goddess of thieves, murderers, people who supposedly sacrificed their victims to her in hidden temples deep in the forest, away from human habitation. Western observers, by the way, starting with the British, particularly saw Kali as the symbol of everything that they found weird and alien in Asian culture. And so, in fact, did many respectable people in India itself. In these early manifestations, her temples were supposed to be at the edge of the village or in the forest. She was associated with the marginal, with that which is outside society, often including yogis and yoginis, because one of the associations of Kali is with bands of fierce woman practitioners known as yoginis, who lived like the marginalized male yogis and utterly eschewed the conventional way of being a woman. So we can see that this view of Kali goes with somewhat primitive stages in human life to people who live close to the land where the fear of time and death is huge, because life is so unpredictable, because, you know, the world is so scary and so willing to kill you. So a goddess like Kali, of course, represents the destructive power of nature to such people. And I was very interested to read a piece online about a month ago when the Kilauea volcano started erupting on the Big Island of Hawaii. I guess it was a few months ago now. Someone wrote a piece about the way Pele is seen among the native people in Hawaii. That, you know, Pele is said to have created the Hawaiian archipelago. The volcanoes of which, you know, within which she lives are actually the top face of the mountains that made those islands. So she's very much revered by the locals, especially on the Big Island. And what they say is that the reason that the Kilauea volcano is erupting is because the U.S. government has drilled for geothermal energy inside on the sides of the volcano, and her eruptions are a sign of her wrath, which is not an untypical way of understanding the way the fierce goddess works. We have historically looked at earthquakes and thunderstorms as signs of the anger of God. Another way that Kali's fierceness is understood is in her identification with the force of time itself. Time, of course, being that property in reality which both makes things grow, because things grow in the fullness of time, and also brings them to an end. So time is really the measure of impermanence. But as culture evolves, so does the image of Kali. And over time, Kali became a city goddess, a temple goddess. She's actually the patron deity of the city of Calcutta, Calicut as it's called now. And her iconography was now understood as being symbolic of the vast power that serves to liberate us. So, for instance, the skulls are no longer dead demons. The skulls become symbolic of the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet, signifying the creative power of language and vibration, which is one of the most important principles in Tantra and in the way that the world is understood in Tantra. As we said a little bit in our conversation about Saraswati last week, the understanding in the Tantric texts is that the primal vibration that arises in the heart of the infinite, which is known as spanda, meaning vibration, that primal vibration takes the specific forms of 52 sounds, which are called matrikas. Matrika literally means mother. And these sounds combine to become the resonance behind everything in the cosmos. And these sounds are still reverberating and creating over and over again, even today. So these 52 skulls are the signs of her command over the creative forces of the universe. And they also, of course, have a subsidiary meaning, because Kali really is the goddess of yogis, especially tantric yogis. In fact, Kali is perhaps the goddess or the deity who above all is associated with the transformative and swift quality of the tantric path. So she is seen as the liberating power who destroys our reliance on convention. So the yogic understanding is that Kali is terrifying only to the false ego, and that to those of us who are willing to look into her face, she reveals the truth, and she reveals herself as Kali Ma. So, but what they find, of course, is that when you look into her face without backing down or giving into fear, you can begin to see the oneness that underlies this differentiated universe. And with that, the image of the scary hag goddess morphs, and we start to see the esoteric meaning. So I want to talk a little bit about the form of Kali. She's usually seen as four-armed, but she can sometimes have six arms or eight arms or even 10 arms, and each of them holds implements that are kind of parsed, and that are, to use the language of scholars, that are coded, C-O-D-E-D, in such a way that they become pregnant symbols of her powers. So, like Bhuvaneshwari, her lower two hands are making the gesture of fear not, which is Abhaya Mudra, the upraised palm, which also, by the way, means stop. So in a certain sense, the upraised palm of Kali says, don't come closer unless I invite you. And her other hand, which is open with the fingers pointing down, is in the gesture of bestowing boons. So, and these two gestures, fear not, do not be afraid of the universe, and accept, receive my gifts are really that they represent the creative aspect of Kali. Her other two hands hold a blood-drenched sword and a severed head, which obviously represent her power of destruction. But they have also this profound esoteric meaning. The sword is the sword of truth. Like Manjushri's sword in Buddhism, it's the power of spiritual knowledge, the knowledge of unity that cuts away our ignorance and confusion and destroys the false self-ego. And I like to think of Kali's sword as being like a lightsaber. You know, in the Advaita traditions, it's said that ignorance is like, ignorance is simply darkness. And that when the light of truth comes into our minds and into our life, it dispels the darkness, and we see that ignorance actually doesn't exist, that all there really is light and truth. So Kali's sword removes the conditioned egotistical self, which is symbolized by the brain, which is symbolized by the head. And the head actually represents the neurophysiological wiring that's set up to give us the experience of a separate I. The texts of the Tantra are very specific about this. I mean, obviously it was a pre-modern tradition. They didn't understand neuroscience, but they intuited it. And I suspect that the sages probably had visionary experiences of how our senses are programmed to make us see the world as outside ourselves and ourselves as powerless. Because so much of the teachings in the traditions on goddess tell us that the goddess, when awakened, begins to transform the way our senses and mind operate so that we're able to see the world inside us. So Kali's sword actually removes our limitations and opens the gates of freedom. Another way they're described is as the sword that cuts our bondage. And in the Tantras, bondage is said to have 8 different qualities of attachment. One of them is shame, which I think is very interesting. Another of them is identification with family. Another is identification with the body. And Kali's sword takes away all these, which is, if you've ever had one of these particular qualities disappear or dissolve, you see how much freedom remains, for instance, when you let go of something that you've been shamed about, or when you let go of feeling that you're limited by where you come from. And of course, Kali's sword also takes away the conditioning of ego. Her tongue, her outstretched tongue, and the fangs that we sometimes see symbolize the conquest of our selfish, greedy tendencies. And what this shows is considered to be totally, shows her how she's completely spiritual, having transcended any impurities. And this understanding of the tongue has kind of an interesting meaning in tantric ritual. This is one of the things that Western scholars are very fascinated by. In certain tantric rituals, as I think most of you know, there's a practice in which practitioners of a certain sort will do a ritual in which they imbibe so-called forbidden substances. And among these are meat, fish, which are not supposed to be okay for people of certain castes to eat in India, sexual fluids, sometimes feces, liquor, sometimes intoxicating psychoactive drugs. So these substances are taken by the type of practitioner that we mentioned earlier, the vira, the hero, who has so much command over himself, they're usually men, but not always, that practitioner can actually overcome disgust and fear and lust by engaging ritually in these forbidden substances. Ramakrishna, we'll talk more about him, at a certain stage in his sadhana, used to touch his tongue to dog shit as part of his practice of inuring himself to see everything in life as sacred. So Akali's color, her blackness, symbolizes her all-embracive, comprehensive nature. Because I'm quoting from David Kinsley, one of the preeminent scholars of goddesses. This is from his book, Hindu Goddesses. Because black is the color in which all other colors merge, her blackness also represents the total absence of color, again signifying that Kali is beyond all forms and qualities. She's the absolute reality that is not touched by anything. And she's also one of the names for that absolute reality is the great void, the Mahashunya. She is that. Her nudity, her nakedness, has a similar meaning. It symbolizes that she's completely beyond names and forms. She's transcendent. She's utterly illuminated with no delusion or veiling whatsoever. So Kali is the mind completely free of thoughts, the heart that is unveiled by any sense of separation. She stands on Shiva's prone body, which, as we've said earlier, represents the ground of being. And in the yoga philosophy of Patanjali, Shiva represents the Purusha, who Purusha is a word that actually literally means man, the unchanging, the unqualified witness of reality, while Kali represents the active prakriti, the nature of the physical world. So in this interpretation, the two of them together are ultimate reality. And another interpretation of Kali standing on Shiva is that, and I love this, she symbolizes the state that we reach by going inside in meditation, in which we absorb the outer into the inner, in order to experience the union, the coming together of these two aspects of reality. The necklace of severed head we've already spoken about as the seed syllables that give rise to everything. As a meditation form, oh, and one other thing, her girdle of severed arms has several really quite interesting meanings. One of the interpretations is that the arms represent how she destroys devotees' karmas. So she literally takes on our karmas. And another interpretation of the arms is that they represent her manifold powers, which she passes on to us when she gives us her grace. So if you consider Kali's form as a meditation form, we could say that when we meditate on Kali, when we love Kali, we are able to see through her form to the absolute totality of the beautiful and the terrible, the union of opposites. So she literally stands for the non-duality that is between past and future, that is between positive and negative, that is between good and evil, because as we know, the worldview of the non-dual Indian tradition, especially the tantric tradition, is that nothing is outside consciousness, and that what in the world of duality is justice, injustice, right and wrong, and which in the world of duality we actually have a responsibility to manage. But in the world of the truth, the absolute reality, all of these opposites dissolve, and that is who Kali is. A poem by Shankaracharya says, "Who are you, O fair auspicious one? You whose hands hold both delight and pain, both the shade of death and the elixir of immortality are your grace, O Mother. And that's kind of about the size of it. So I want to talk a little bit about Ramakrishna, and then we're going to do one of my favorite Kali practices. As I said, to talk about Kali, to understand Kali, really asks us to tune into Ramakrishna, because he was perhaps of all of her devotees, of certainly of the modern age, the one who was most able to explore and explain who she really is. So Ramakrishna was from a village in Bengal. He was a Brahmin, a member of the priestly caste, and from a young age, he served as a priest in the temple, called Dakshineshwar, which Dakshineshwar means the goddess of the right hand path. Dakshin Kali is one of the names of Kali that is actually the form of Kali that we're mostly talking about today. From an early age, Ramakrishna was in love with God, and there's a beautiful story about how when he was a child, he went into samadhi for the first time while watching a flight of cranes, herons, across the monsoon sky. In India, during the monsoon, the clouds become very big and very black. So watching these white cranes across the sky opened him to the utter, absolute awe and wonder of life. So Kali became his chosen deity, and his longing for intimacy with the goddess was so intense that he was ready to offer everything to her, including his own life. And Ramakrishna had a very passionate, dramatic inner life, which, if you're interested, there's a few books about him. The easiest one to read is by Christopher Isherwood. It's called Ramakrishna and His Disciples. And as some of you know, it was the first spiritual book I ever read. And to this day, it's really a major text that continually reveals new secrets. So if you haven't read it, I recommend it. And a lot of what we know about Ramakrishna comes from the stories he told his disciples. One of the very famous ones is that his longing for a vision of the goddess was such that he used to say that his heart was being wrung out like a wet towel. And eventually he picked up the sword from her image in the temple and threatened to kill himself if she didn't reveal herself to him. And she obliged him. And this is what he saw. These are his words. The buildings with their different parts, the temple and everything else, vanished from my sight, leaving no trace whatsoever. In their stead, I saw a limitless, infinite, effulgent ocean of consciousness. As far as the eye could see, the shining billows were madly rushing at me from all sides with a terrific noise to swallow me up. Within me was a steady flow of divine bliss, altogether new, and I felt the presence of the Divine Mother. So that was Ramakrishna's first experience. He experienced being completely absorbed in Kali as in an ocean of bliss. And it was a very, very radical vision that his disciples, especially Swami Vivekananda, brought to the West, and which actually informs, for many of us, our practice to this day. Ramakrishna being, in a certain sense, the testament. He offered the testament to this level of non-duality. And he believed, in India it's taught that all paths lead to God. And Ramakrishna intended to find out if that was true. So he believed that real spirituality is an experimental endeavor where you take the practices that the sages recommended, and then you apply them, you do them, you do the practices for long enough so that you can see the effects. And that's that way you find out if what the sages have told us is really true. And I've kind of tried to follow this path myself. It's very, very powerful to look at your practice as an experiment in validating the teachings of the sages. And it's possible to do it, as Ramakrishna certainly demonstrated. So he followed the practices of many different traditions. He did the tantric sexual practice with a traveling tantric practitioner whom he called the Brahmani. He dressed up as a woman to worship Krishna and did such a good job as a woman that he was able to be inside the secret woman's rooms in his patron's house, and nobody knew that he was a man. He did Islamic practice. He prayed like a Christian until he had visions of Jesus. He practiced the self-inquiry of Vedanta. He did Islamic practice. And in every path he followed, he would end up in the same place, experiencing himself and the world as the Divine Mother. So when he would teach that all paths lead to the same goal, he literally knew what he was talking about. He ended up as an ecstatic being, dancing and singing with his disciples, falling into ecstatic trances, giving powerful teachings, which he said were not his, but were the goddess's teachings. He would say, she uses me as her mouthpiece. But Ramakrishna's channeling of goddess Kali was for many, many seekers, and I think in ways that we don't fully appreciate to this day, really changed the course of our understanding of spirituality, not only in India, where, you know, what he said had a long history, but also in the West. In that he really brought to bear a radically non-dual teaching that we have really begun to experiment with and make our own in the 20th century. So let's close our eyes. And this time, imagine that the mantra and the breath are flowing in through the crown, as though you were drawing in Kali's light in the form of particles of white light through the crown of the head. And with the inhalation, you draw in the mantras, Om Kali Ma. And with the exhalation, you feel the light and the energy of the mantras flowing through your body. if Bhuvaneshwari is the great womb within which the universe is held, the great creative womb that brings forth new life, Kali is the energy of birth itself. I would say that for human beings, the process of giving birth is one of the most profound and practical demonstrations of the fact that when push comes to shove, it's the universe who's living through us. You know, there's nothing that a mother can do either to stop the process or to make it happen faster than it wants to, even though, of course, nowadays we have drugs and different interventions which can transform the way this happens. But nonetheless, the birth process in its natural form is the greatest example we have of how the Kali energy works. She literally pushes the child out of the womb. And this quality of pushing us past our, let's call it, comfort zone. I'm not sure how comfortable the womb is, but let's assume that it feels safe to us. It's really, this is how she works throughout our life. One tantric teacher, Rudy Ballantyne, says that Kali is that force inside us that goes now and then pushes us forward into transformation. And, you know, we all know that when we really are tuned in to the way life works, we know that in every creative process, every change process, there's a moment when it's time to act, and we have to act. If we don't, we lose the opportunity. You know, it's because reality is going to push the eject button on the old ways, and it's the moment when you can grasp onto the new ways. So at such a moment, the only mistake we can make is to hold back. And one of the gifts that Kali gives us is that shove, which keeps us moving forward even when everything in us wants to stick to the old routine. Without her, we would literally be stuck in our ruts forever. So in dynamic systems theory, which is the scientific study of self-organizing systems, of which you and I are self-organizing systems, it's said that in individual development, the precursor to great transformation is nearly always some kind of disequilibrium or disruptive event. Of which, of course, being ejected from the womb is an example, or the disruption that happens during our teenage years when we are literally being transformed through a radical growth process from childhood to the verge of adulthood. But for many of us, the disruption, the experience that most, you know, validates this understanding is a kind of disruptive event, a divorce, a serious illness, you know, the death of someone close to us, the loss of a job or a spouse, is very often the precursor to a spiritual awakening. And this is one of Kali's most potent forms, the disruption that leads to new forms of growth. In other words, to allow for deep transformation, it's necessary for there to be a destruction of the existing forms. In that famous example that, you know, teachers of transformation have used again and again, the idea that the caterpillar goes into the cocoon and dissolves in order that the material of the caterpillar body can become a butterfly. So we love that nurturing aspect of the feminine, which is the Bhuvaneshwari energy, which we could say is perhaps the energy that creates the butterfly out of the dissolving molecules of the caterpillar. But nonetheless, we can't stay in the womb forever. And, you know, we are in a time where disruption is the name of the game, in which if you're not growing, we're dying. So obviously in innovative cultures like the tech culture, one of the secrets that they've learned is that in order to play the creative game, you have to be willing to fail. You have to be willing to crash and burn a few times. So somehow they have figured out that in order for growth to happen, there needs to be disruption of the old. And, of course, the word disruption, maybe it's no longer code for innovation, but certainly was for many years. The point being, of course, that you can't bring anything new into the world if you're not willing to play with Kali, because she is going to bubble up from inside our complacency and yell, pay attention. And this was my constant experience when I was living with my guru, who was really a Kali guru, if I've ever met one. And in traditional circles in India, this is something we don't always get in the West, but part of the guru archetype is the fiery teacher who is, you know, as my guru used to say, the guru is death to the ego. This is a phrase he loved. He once asked me to collect his writings on the guru and craft them into an essay that he called "The Guru is Death." So part of the function of the guru is to dissolve the ego, to destroy the ego in the disciple. And this is a messy process and often very, very unpleasant and often leaves scars, which we then have to heal. I think it's one of the misunderstandings that we often have about the radical spiritual path and the radical guru path, which is that spiritual growth is supposed to be sweet. In fact, spiritual growth can be very sweet, but the really radical transformations are not necessarily so sweet and demand a willingness to surrender that can be quite radical. One of the things I've learned from contemplating Kali is something about the process of surrender, which is a bit like what happens when you're swimming in the ocean or surfing and a wave breaks over your head. You know, when the surf is about to break over your head, you usually can't ride it. You mostly do better to dive into it, especially if you're not a surfer. Great surfers, of course, can ride a breaking wave. But for you and I, it's probably best to dive into the midst of it, where, of course, if you've ever done this, you find yourself in a place of enormous stillness. And the quality of surrendering to Kali is actually a form of recognizing yourself as Kali's child. In other words, to dance with Kali, the best way is to think of yourself as her child. And then when you look at her, not as the power of destruction or even as the power of liberation, but as Ma Kali, as your divine mother, the divine mother who can protect you the way the tiger mom protects her cub and who can push you through resistance in ways that can turn you into your own creative version of a tantric hero or heroine, that's when her love can turn your heart into a field of light. So even though the shadow side of Kali appears in powerful and frightening, twisted ways, in problematic ways, she also appears as radical empowerment. And really the most intense transformative energies in our psyche. And I just want to say this again, how, because it's one of the things that we most deeply misunderstand about life. In the Western traditions, that we're taught to look at the dark, at darkness, as a problem, as wrong, as a sign that something has gone terribly wrong in the universe. So violence and our own dark impulses leave us in profound confusion. So the Kali image, along with other images of fierce divinity out of Indian mythology, perhaps relate to the fact that life in India for centuries and still today was deeply difficult, you know, precarious, terrible things happened, and somehow if you weren't to be a victim of it, you had to learn to see the terror also as a part of God. And one of the things that happens when we do that is that we lose our victim consciousness and we actually do become able to dance with it. And we stop getting confused about believing that God is only good and that anything that is not good, according to our understanding of good, cannot be God. This turnaround, which is certainly counterintuitive and certainly goes against the way we would prefer to think of the world, is nonetheless the absolute secret of recognizing the truth. So one of the most powerful things about Kali, from a psychological point of view, is that she actually shows us how to hold the contradictions both inside the natural world and also inside ourselves without polarizing reality. So in other words, without demonizing the wild and the destructive and the aggressive, we can use her form as a way in which we can come to terms with our own shadow energies. It doesn't mean that we follow our shadow energies, because, you know, as so many of you know, because we do this practice a lot, the way to hold our own darkness, our own negative emotions, our own intensity, is not to act it out, but to learn how to hold it in presence, how to be present with it, and how to allow these energies to express themselves in a way that they actually can be, they can be brought into the light and literally liberated. I have a friend who's a spinal surgeon who used to do operations on people with back issues, and mostly they didn't work. As I think many of you know, back surgery sometimes is effective, but there are many conditions where it, you know, it doesn't really relieve the pain. And as he studied this problem and also began to deal with his own physical pain, he discovered a practice which I think was written about in one of the books that came out in the 80s about working with physical pain. And the process was of writing out his anger and grief. So he learned, and this is a process I recommend, and that is in the homework assignment for this week. He would sit down pretty much daily, and he would write about the things he felt charged about, you know, what had made him angry. He would write about his frustration. He would write about his feelings of isolation. He would write about his anger at his parents and his anger at his wife. He would write all this using emotional words, and then he would tear up the paper and throw it away. And this is, as he said, when he recommends this practice, it's really important to tear up the paper, because what you're actually doing when you write out your feelings of anger, grief, rage, frustration, jealousy, all those intense negative feelings, you actually take them out of your body. You objectify them. And then when you throw them away, over time, as you do this practice, it actually frees your body. Your pain stops being, you stop being the victim of your pain. He says that you actually have to do this regularly. It's not something you can just do once. And the practice that I'm going to, that we're going to do now, is similar to that, but it doesn't involve writing. And it's a practice for dissolving emotional stuckness and karmic stuckness. One thing that we often don't realize is that the karmas that we're holding that feel particularly sticky to us, the ones that cause the most pain, are very often the result of things that were done to us, often in early childhood. And I think almost all of us understand this fact about how we have these experiences in early childhood that we don't know how to work with or assimilate, and so they come into our bodies and we wall them off and we're not able to deal with them. So they become, you know, kind of some scaric pockets in our consciousness that then sit in our unconscious and influence the way we react to situations in our daily life. So this is a practice for harnessing the power of Kali to let go of karmic residue. And you can do this without having any idea of what the cause was of the karmic difficulty. It's an incredibly effective practice, and it's a particularly Kali-esque aspect of the practice of letting go of karmas. So let's take a couple of deep breaths. Have the feeling that you're breathing in the most awake, the most loving, and the most precise, powerful aspect of the goddess. Inhaling with Om Kali Ma, exhaling with Om Kali Ma. Allow the mantra to interact with the energy of your own consciousness so that it creates a kind of a field within you. And into this field, bring the thought of a recent event that had charge for you. And what we're going to work with is not the event and not our story about the event, but the charge in the event. Because where that charge comes from, what makes it sticky and painful, even if our charge is about a mistake that we made, about, you know, something that we have said or done that we deeply regret, very often the charge in it, the thing that makes it so painful, the shame we feel or the sense of victimization or the anger, very often that comes from stored samskaras. And this particular method is one of the ways to actually work with those samskaras in the moment. Kali really loves to work intensely in the moment. So deep breath in and a deep breath out. Bring into your attention this sense of an incident about which you have charge. And then turn your head to the side, one side or the other. Exhale sharply through the mouth with the feeling that you're breathing out the charge around this event. Do this three times and then say out loud or to yourself very forcefully, I give you back your karma. I give you back your karma. I give you back your karma. You don't have to know who it is that you're giving the karma back to. The universe knows, consciousness knows. continue with this for 9 breaths in increments of 3. I give you back your karma. I give you back your karma. I give you back your karma. If it feels complete, you can relax and come back to the mantra. But I suspect that for many of us, there may be tendrils of charge associated with this. So continue to exhale forcefully through the mouth, through pursed lips, and to think or say, I give you back your karma. I give you back your karma. So my hope is that you'll experiment with this practice through the week. As I said, it's in your homework. But right now, just take a moment to turn your attention inside and notice what the effect of this practice has been. And then we're going to have Q&A. So Deb?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, ma'am. You can tell everyone how it's going to work.
Okay. So if you want to ask a question, you can hit star 2. Or for those that are on the webcast, they can post a question, and I will do the asking. So, and I know we do already have one Q&A for Laurel. She asked, she's intrigued by the Kachari Mudra, Okay, as it happens spontaneously, do you know any source to taste this teaching more deeply? She said she searched on the net and found a few things, but she's intrigued to learn more.
Actually, one of the best explanations of it I know is in my guru's autobiography, which is called The Play of Consciousness, and he describes his own experience of Kachari Mudra. It's also in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, Light on Yoga, which is available in several translations. And you might also, if you look up Hatha Yoga Pradipika, you might be able to find it on the web. I think that there are PDFs of it that you can download. I assume, Laurel, that you're experiencing the Kachari Mudra where your tongue moves backwards up into the nasal cavity, which is a fairly amazing yogic kriya that occurs spontaneously through practice. Kachari Mudra also refers to a subtle experience. This is the kind of physical yogic mudra of it, but the subtle experience is the experience of your awareness literally dissolving into what's sometimes called the sky of consciousness. Kachari means sky of consciousness, actually. The Kachari Shaktis are those energies in consciousness that are responsible for telling us who we are. So ordinarily the Kachari Shaktis give us the experience of being you know, Laurel or being Sally or being in a separate person in a body. But as Shakti begins to liberate our consciousness, the Khichdi Shaktis start to give us the experience that of I am consciousness, I am that, I am Kali, I am goddess. So the physical practice, the physical yogic practice where the tongue goes up through the back of the throat and actually goes up into the nasal cavities is said to open the pathways that lead to the awakening of the Ajna chakra, the sixth chakra. The point of that, the purpose of that being to give us the capacity to know ourselves as consciousness. So it's a great experience, and as I said, Play of Consciousness, there's an index, so look up Khichdi Mudra if you happen to have Play of Consciousness. And if not, I would suggest you buy it. It's kind of an amazing book. So thank you, Laurel.
Okay, if anybody has a question, press star 2.
Or you can share your experience of the practice we just did.
Got one more question here from Laurel. She says, could you say more about the cave of the heart? This seems to me related to Kali, at least in the moment. Everything is related to Kali. Drawn to the deepest heart cave, healing with Kali Ma. And she says, thank
yes.
you.
Beautiful. Well, the cave of the heart has several different meanings. One of them is literally the inner experience of being inside the heart chakra, the heart center, which, you know, we often actually do a practice where we imagine ourselves, the area behind the breastbone, as a cave, and see that within that cave there's a light, there's a flame, which can be seen in meditation in the heart. So the cave of the heart, in one sense, refers to the open spaciousness of the area behind the breastbone where the light of consciousness is seen in the heart in the form of a flame. But like all of these ideas, the cave of the heart is also a reference to the great heart, to consciousness itself, in which our discursive mind dissolves as if we have gone into a cave where the outside world is completely dissolved, and we begin to experience ourselves as inside this deep, deep, very profoundly loving darkness, this void energy, which, as you say, is one of the experiences of Kali. So the cave of the heart can be the heart center in the chest, or it can mean the expansion of your awareness such that the entire world seems to be contained within your consciousness or within your heart. So thank you for that beautiful question.
Okay. Can you ask, you mentioned 8 sources of bondage but didn't name them all. What are the others?
No, I didn't. I did not name them all. And unfortunately, I am not able to name them all at the moment. Though they are in the Kulārṇava Tantra, and I promise I will look them all up and send them to you on the listserv. So this is another good reason for tuning into the listserv. Shame is one of them. Pride is another. Caste is another. Family identification is another. Another is identification with your successes and your gifts. And the others will come your way.
Okay. I think this is Bob. I think Bob just raised his hand. Is that Bob?
Hi, Bob.
I've got somebody in Maine.
Oh, hi, it's Susan.
Oh,
it must be
Susan.
Bob's my husband.
Bob's your husband, okay. Right. No, Bob's your uncle, right.
Crazy Bob. Thanks for taking the call, Sally. So helpful. So my question, there's so many thoughts about it, so I'm just going to start it. With Kali, I think there's always been some deep fear of fully embodying that Kali energy, which I do really embody. People always say that, and I feel like I have that wildness. But there's a fear of I could go completely crazy dancing forever. And then in my family, there's mental illness and bipolar. So I feel I hold this Bhuvaneshwari energy, and that's what I do through my work. And then I hold this Kali energy is just like I'm always playing in life and in the adventure. But how do you balance, and am I missing something else? How do you balance all that? I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. So, this is life. This is actually, in my experience, this is our life work, is learning how to allow the energies, the different energies that express themselves through our personality, to first of all join with the divine aspect of them. And secondly, to come into a kind of balance. So if, you know, I think one thing to know about Bhuvaneshwari and Kali is that they are aspects of the one goddess. In fact, they're aspects of a group of goddesses called the Mahavidyas, or the great wisdom goddesses. So Bhuvaneshwari is one of the faces of Kali. She's a gentle, creative face of Kali. And Kali is the wild, ecstatic face of Bhuvaneshwari. So if you understand that these are two facets of yourself, you can also learn how to summon the appropriate energy at the appropriate time. And there are times when we absolutely need to express the Kali energy. If we don't, if we repress it, first of all, we cut ourselves off from one of our major sources of self-transformative power and our power to transform others. And also, if we repress that energy, it makes us sick, basically. It's, you know, Kali energy, when turned inside, is one of the energies that's, you know, quite destructive to our health. So, again, this is going to be in the homework, but I would really, really advise you to spend a little time this week sitting with a piece of paper. I think it's better to do it by hand than on the computer, and ask Kali to give you the answer to this question. In other words, how do you want to express yourself in my life now? You ask the question, you write the question with your dominant hand, and then you write the answer with your non-dominant hand, and you may have done this exercise before. It's a very helpful practice for finding out what the unconscious wants to say to you. But I would suggest that you do that and ask her the questions that you want the answers to, such as, you know, how does this Kali energy relate to the mental instability in my family? Is it okay for me to let her speak in public? Why am I scared of you? You know, what do you need and want? I mean, really get into the habit of dialoguing with her, and you can do this with Bhuvaneshwari also. And then ask her to show you how to balance these energies. I've found over the course of my life that when we're trying to work with intense energies in our psyche, that it's best to start solo, to start when we're by ourselves, unless you have, you know, a very good friend who's willing to be a witness for you, which is even better. It's one of the rules, of course, that therapists assume, and I suspect you do this for other people as well. So you could do this with a partner, but the process of asking questions and then writing the answers is not just informational. It's not just informative. It also is transformative. In other words, by letting Kali speak through your hands, you find out what Kali has to say to you, what Kali has to show you. So I hope that helps, and I hope you'll experiment, Susan, with this practice, and let us know what happens. It's a very, very powerful practice. And I also would say that a lot of us are afraid of our wild energies for precisely the reason that you give, because we're afraid that it's crazy and that if we give into it, we'll be crazy. And I think your intuition that the Bhuvaneshwari energy, the holding energy, that wide mother energy is actually one of the most protective ways in which we can be present to our own wildness without suppressing it or repressing it. And my experience in myself, with myself, is that when I let Kali speak through me in situations in which nobody else is involved, when I'm alone, when I'm dancing, or when I'm singing loudly, or when I'm writing out my anger about a situation, or, really asking Kali to speak, a lot of stuff gets resolved and freed through these processes. So give yourself some time to dance. In fact, I want to give you all an assignment, which is, I'd like to ask you to do at least once this week, which is to sit in meditation with Om Kali Ma, which is our practice for the week, and then allow the energy to flow in, as we were doing earlier, to flow in through the crown, to fill your body. And you can say the mantra out loud, or you can just meditate with it, with the, as a silent mantra. And then at a certain point, just get up and dance. You can put on music or you can sing loudly. I like to do that. I like to chant Om Kali Ma and dance, but it's also quite wonderful to put on a rock and roll song or African music, highly rhythmic music, or a kirtan, which has, strong drums in it. And chanting and dancing are really great. Let her express herself through your body.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. And dancing and chanting are like the best things in the world that I love to do. And when you were talking, maybe I just heard this, but or I don't know if I heard it right, but when you were saying Bhuvaneshwari and Kali, like they're the same and together. So if I can remember that and hold them together, then that will make it easier, right?
Totally. And it also integrates these, it's because, tantric practice and goddess practice, in fact, is really all about integration. We don't want to get rid of qualities in our character that make us uncomfortable, or qualities, in the world around us that make us uncomfortable. We want to find a way to integrate them. And Bhuvaneshwari, this wide presence that we associate with Bhuvaneshwari is really, it's the integrative force of consciousness itself, right? So,
yeah.
And Kali is that also, but she's that in a much more active and, for many of us, problematic form. So if you can hold your consciousness of Bhuvaneshwari's big embrace and let Kali dance, then you start to see, oh, okay, I can appear as Bhuvaneshwari in this circumstance, and I can let myself be free to be Kali in that circumstance. And as they integrate, then Bhuvaneshwari comes with the power of Kali behind her, and Kali comes with the wideness and subtlety of Bhuvaneshwari behind her. And you realize that these are faces of the one goddess. So it's I believe I said this earlier, but if not, I'll say it. And if I and if you've heard it before, just consider this driving the point home. You know that the thing with Tantra is that that fundamentally true tantric practitioners understand that all goddesses are faces of the one goddess of Maheshwari, of of Bhuvaneshwari, of Kali Ma. Those are all names through which the great goddess expresses herself. And sometimes she's beautiful, sometimes she's terrible, but she's never many. She's one, even when she's appearing as the many. And this recognition that Bhuvaneshwari and Kali, Lakshmi, Saraswati, and one of the really intense goddesses like Dumavati or Bagalamukhi, who are look like hags and are ready to stab you if you look at them cross-eyed. That all of these are facets of the natural world and facets of goddess. And that behind all these faces is the love that's at the heart of creation. So goddess practice is meant to help us recognize this and to help us hold the wildness and craziness while at the same time holding the openness, the motherly love, the embraces possibilities. And together they empower us to the max. They empower us to be warriors of love, to be mothers of the universe, to be children of the universe, while at the same time being, standing for the great structure consciousness of the Father. It's really an amazing kaleidoscope of possibility that the goddess offers us.
Mm.
So thank you,
Susan. Beautiful.
Thank you so much.
For that. That was beautiful.
Yeah. And so was your question. And the concern that you expressed in the question is one of the great issues that we all experience and need to articulate. So, my dears, it's time for us to part for this evening. The homework is on its way, even as we speak. And I hope you have a beautiful day of independence in the United States and in, of course, the independence of divine freedom throughout the world. And we'll be together next week for our deepening experience with Goddess Lakshmi. But this week, give yourself permission to throw yourself into Kali's arms and experience her intensity. And as in all of its excitement and all of its subtlety and all of its love. So have a fantastic week. Thank you so much for being here. So much love. Namaste.